People who wouldn't go near an atomic plant lived downstream from dams.
So why do you hate that place?
Hooker asked.
Maybe we ought to save it.
God damn it, no, Jerry Owen said. Alim shot Hooker a look. Now you've started him off again, it said. It's too much, don't you see that? Owen demanded. Atomic power makes people think you can solve problems with technology. Bigger and bigger. More quick fixes. You have the power, so you use it. And soon you need more, and then you're ripping 10 billion tons a year of coal out of the earth. Pollution. Cities so big they rot in the center. Ghettos. Don't you see? Atomic power makes it easy to live out of balance with nature. For a while. Until finally you can't get back in balance. The hammer gave us a chance to go back to living the way we were evolved to live. To be kind to the earth.
All right, damn it, Hooker said. You take 200 men and 2 mortars and go shuck that plant. Make sure the Prophet knows what you're doing. Maybe he'll shut up long enough to let me organize.
Hooker stared at the map.
You go play, Owen. We gotta go after the real enemy.
He'll ask for volunteers, Hooker thought, and he smiled. The crazies would go with Owen and leave Hooker alone for a while. The room Adolf Weigley took Tim to was beautiful. Granted that it was crowded, a massive wave of cables surged through a wall, divided, subdivided, ran in metal raceways overhead. But there were lights, electric lights. Neatly enameled green panels lined 2 walls, busy with dials and lights and switches, and clean with the dust-filtered cleanliness of an operating room. Tim asked, "What is this, the main control room?" Weigley laughed. He was chronically cheerful, free from the jumpiness of disaster syndrome, and elaborately casual about all the technology. A baby-smooth face made him look younger than he was. The Stronghold men generally wore beards.
"No, it's a cable-spreading room," he said. "But it's the only place we've got that you can sleep in. It wouldn't be smart to push any buttons."
His smile was sly and partly concealed. Tim laughed.
"Not me."
He gazed euphorically at fire extinguishers and winking lights and massive cables, everything precisely in place, all glowing in indirect lighting. Power hummed softly in his ear. Dolph said,
"Drop your backpack over there. There'll be others sleeping in here, too. Mind you stay out of the way. Duty operators have to get in here. Sometimes they have to work fast."
His grin faded.
"And there's a lot of voltage in some of those lines. Stay out of the way."
"Sure," Tim said. "Tell me, Dolph, what's your job here?" Weigley seemed too young to be an engineer, but he wasn't built like one of the construction workers.
"Power system apprentice," Weigley said, "which means we do everything. Got that stuff settled. Let's go. They told me to show you around and help you set up the radio."
"Right. What does it mean, everything?" Weigley shrugged.
"When I'm on duty, I sit in the control room and drink coffee and play cards until the duty operator decides something needs working on. Then I go do it. That could be anything at all. Get a reading on a dial, put out a fire, throw a switch, turn a valve, repair a break in a cable. Anything."
"So you're a robot for the engineers."
"Engineers?
The duty operators."
"They aren't engineers. They got their job doing what I do. One day I'll be an operator, if there's anything left to operate. Hell, Hobie Latham started by walking on snowshoes in the Sierra, measuring the snow to find out how much spring runoff we could expect, and he's operations manager now."
They went outside into the muddy yard. The big earthen levees loomed high around them. Men worked on them, putting up forms, while others poured in concrete to reinforce the cofferdam that kept SJNP safe. Others did incomprehensible things with forklifts. The yard was a bustle of activity, seemingly chaotic, but everyone seemed to know what he was doing. It made Tim feel curiously vulnerable to stand inside the project grounds and know that the water outside was 30 feet above them. San Joaquin Nuclear Project was a sunken island, surrounded by levees thrown up by bulldozers. Pumps took care of seepage through the earthen walls. One break in the levees, or a day without power to the pumps, would drown them. The Dutch had lived with that knowledge all their lives, and what they feared had come to pass. Holland couldn't conceivably have survived the tidal waves following Hammerfall.
"I think the best place for your radio is on one of the cooling towers," Dolph said. "But those are cut off from the plant."
He climbed a board staircase to the top of the levee and pointed. Across 100 feet of water, the cooling towers loomed up, 4 of them set inside a smaller levee that had leaked badly. Their bases were partly flooded. A thick white plume rose from each of the towers, climbed into the sky, growing ghostly, finally vanishing.
"They won't have any trouble finding this place," Tim said.
"No."
"Hey, I thought nuclear plants were non-polluting."
Dolph Weigley laughed.
"That's no pollution. Steam, that's all it is. Water vapor. How could it be smoke? We're not burning anything."
He pointed to a narrow planked footbridge leading from the levee to the nearest tower.
"That's the only way over, unless we get out a boat. But I still think it's the best place for the radio."
"So do I, but we can't carry the antenna on that plank."
"Sure we can. You ready? Let's get the stuff."
Tim gingerly climbed the slanting ladder that zigzagged up the side of the big redwood tower. Once again, he was impressed with the organization at SJNP. Weigley had gone into the yard and come back with men to carry the radio, car batteries, and antenna, and they'd skipped along the narrow plank bridge with all the stuff in one trip, then gone back to work. No questions, no arguments, no protests. Maybe Hammerfall had changed more than marriage patterns. Tim remembered from the papers that SJNP had been plagued with strikes and arguments over which union would represent whom, overtime pay, living conditions. Labor troubles had delayed the station almost as long as the environmentalists who'd done their best to kill it. He reached the top of the 50-foot tower. He was about 30 feet above the level of the sea. The base of the tower was surrounded by a leaking dam, and pumps worked to keep its intakes clear. There was a strong wind into the tower at its bottom. The thing was big, over 200 feet in diameter. The deck where Tim stood was a large metal plate pierced by innumerable holes. Pumps brought water up and poured it onto the deck, where it stood a few inches high. It trickled down into the tower and vanished. Above him, a dozen smaller cylindrical columns jutted 20 feet above the deck. Steam poured out of each one. The deck vibrated with the hum of pumps.
"This is a good place for the radio," Tim said.
He looked doubtfully out across the San Joaquin Sea.
"But it's a little exposed."
Weigley shrugged.
"We can put some sandbags up, build a shelter, and we can string a telephone line from here back to the plant. Question is, do you want the radio here?"
"Let's find out." It took an hour to get the beam antenna set up and clamped onto one of the smaller rising Venturi columns. Tim connected the CB set to the batteries. They carefully rotated the beam antenna to point 20 degrees magnetic, and Tim looked at his watch.
"They won't be listening for a quarter hour. Let's take a break. Tell me how things are going here. We were really surprised to find out you were here, that the plant was going."
Weigley found a perch on the rail.
"It surprises me sometimes," he said.
"Were you here when..."
"Yeah. None of us believed the comet would hit us, of course. As far as Mr. Price was concerned, it was just another working day. He was mad about absenteeism. A lot of the crew didn't show up. Then, when it did hit, that just made it worse. We didn't have all our people."
"I still don't see how you could do it," Tim said.
"Price is a genius," Weigley said. "As soon as we knew, even before the earthquake, he was getting things set for survival. He had those bulldozers out scraping up a levee before the rain hit us. He sent me and some others out into the valley to the railroad to fill up the tank trucks. Diesel fuel, gasoline, we got all we could. And there was a boxcar on the siding, full of flour and beans, and Mr. Price made us get all of it. We're sure glad he did. There's not much variety, but we didn't starve. Why are you laughing?"
"The fishermen feel the same way."
"Who doesn't? Can you believe you'll never taste a banana again? We could use some orange juice, for that matter. We're worried about scurvy." The orange tree is extinct in California. Sometimes we can dig some tang out of a market.
The longer Tim looked at that wall of earth between him and the San Joaquin Sea, the bigger it got.
Dolph, how could you have put that up while the valley was flooding?
We couldn't have. It's a crazy story.
The original idea was to put the plant over nearer to Wasco. Mr. Price wanted it up here, on the ridge, because the blowdown from the cooling towers would drain better. We wouldn't have to dig the ponds as deep. The department's managers didn't like that. Made the plant more visible.
Oh, but it's beautiful. It's like a 1930s Amazing Stories cover. The future.
That's what Mr. Price said. Anyway, they did put the plant up here on the ridge.
It wasn't much of a ridge, of course. No more than a low, rolling hill. The plant wasn't more than 20 feet higher than the surrounding valley.
And after they did the work, the department got scared and they built the levees, Weigley said. Not for any real reason, just to hide the plant, so the environmentalists wouldn't think about it when they drove along Interstate 5.
Weigley's lips tightened.
And then some of the bastards who tried to kill the plant raised hell because we spent the extra money on the levee. But it came in handy. All we had to do was bulldoze up enough dirt to fill the gaps, the places where the roads and railway came in through the screening banks. And a good thing, too. That water rose fast after Hammerfall.
I'll bet. I drove over that sea, Tim said.
How's that?
Tim explained.
Heard any stories about Flying Dutchman?
Weigley shook his head.
But we haven't had much contact with outsiders. Mayor Allen didn't think it would be a good idea.
Allen? I saw him.
How'd he get here? Showed up just before the water got too deep. He was in City Hall when the tidal wave came through Los Angeles. Man, has he got a story to tell. Anyway, he showed up the next day with a dozen cops and City Hall people. You know, Los Angeles owned the plant before Hammerfall.
So Mayor Allen is the boss here?
No, Mr. Price is in charge. The mayor's a guest, just like you. What does he know about power plants?
Tim didn't point out that it was Weigley who told him the mayor was the one who discouraged outside contacts. So you've ridden out the end of the world, Tim said, by keeping the plant going.
What are you planning to do with it?
Weigley shrugged.
That's up to Mr. Price, and don't think it's been any soft job keeping things running. Everything's got to work all the time. We can put out 1,000 megawatts.
That sounds like a lot of
10 million light bulbs,
Weigley grinned.
A lot, yeah. How long can you keep that up? At full capacity, about a year. But we're not running full, and we won't ever be. It takes about 10 megawatts to operate the plant. Cooling pumps, control equipment, the lights, you know. That's 1% of capacity, so we could keep that up for 100 years. But then we've got another set of fuel elements over in number 2.
Tim looked back at the plant. 2 enormous concrete domes, which contained the nuclear reactors. Each had a series of rectangular buildings attached that contained the turbines and control equipment.
Number 2's not operational, Weigley said. Getting her up will be our first job once the water's gone down, and then we'll be able to put 20 megawatts online for somebody else to use. We can keep that up for 50 years.
50 years, Tim thought about that.
In 50 years, the United States had gone from a horse and buggy to an automobile civilization, had opened mines, built cities, built industries, discovered electronics and computers, taken spaceflight from comic books to the moon. And this one plant could put out more power than the whole United States generated in the 20s.
That's exciting. My God, it was worth coming here. Forrester was right. Letting anything happen to this plant wouldn't be an optimum solution.
Oh?
Weigley gave Tim a puzzled look.
Tim grinned.
Nothing. Time to try the radio out. To enter the conference room was like walking into the past, straight into a board of directors meeting. It was all there, the long table with comfortable chairs, pads of paper, blackboards, chalk and erasers, even wooden pointers. Tim was jolted. He wondered what Al Hardy would give for a well-equipped conference room and bulletin boards to hang maps and lists on, file cabinets. There was an argument in progress. Johnny Baker waved Tim to a seat on his left. Tim whispered rapidly. The radio gave mostly static, but it worked. They had communications with the stronghold. No further news. Baker whispered thanks and turned back to listen. They looked like human scarecrows, diversely dressed, most of them armed, pale as ghosts except for Mayor Allen and a black detective investigator. Their clothes were old, their shoes were worn. A few months ago they would have looked wildly out of place here. Now it was the room that was strange. The people were normal, except that they were so clean. Tim wriggled inside his clothes. His hand patted his smooth-shaven cheek. Clean. There was hot water for bathing and working electric razors. The washer-dryer hadn't stopped since the stronghold party arrived. His shirt and shorts and socks were clean and dry. Tim wriggled and tried to listen. He was hearing the same sentence over and over again.
"I didn't know there was going to be a goddamn army after us."
Barry Price wasn't as large as the construction crew chief who confronted him, but there was no question who was in charge. Price wore khaki field clothing, bush jacket, and a shirt bulging with pens. A pocket calculator hung from his belt. An assistant with a clipboard hovered nearby. His brush haircut and precisely trimmed pencil mustache made him look almost finicky. He said,
"So what's changed? We were never popular."
"No, damn it, but a cannibal army!"
It wasn't heat that made the crew chief sweat inside his hard hat.
"Barry, we gotta get out of here."
"There's nowhere to go."
"Nuts. West side of the sea. Any place. But we can't stay here. We cannot fight a whole army."
"We have to," Price said.
"How can we let all this go down the drain? Robin, you worked as hard as anybody. We've got allies now."
"Some allies. A dozen men."
Robin Lahmer leaned across the table toward Barry Price. They might have been alone in the room. Certainly nobody was interrupting.
"Look, everything's got to work or nothing does, right?"
"Right."
"So they get one hit on the turbines, the switchyard, the cable rooms, the control rooms, and that's it. We're underwater, and nothing ever works again."
"I know all that," Price said. "So we don't let them get one hit."
"Bullshit, Barry. I'm pulling out. Any of my people want to come with me, I'll take. We'll give them back, but we're borrowing your boats."
"Not mine, you don't," Johnny Baker said.
He sat at Barry Price's left, just across the table from Mayor Allen.
"I did not bring boats to help evacuate this plant."
Lahmer seemed about to argue, then he shrugged.
"So I take the boats that were already here. One of them's mine anyway. That one I keep. But we're leaving."
He stalked out of the room. As he passed Tim Hamner, Tim told him, "You'll never be clean again." Lahmer broke stride, then kept going. Baker asked,
"Shouldn't we stop him?"
"How?"
Price demanded. Baker dropped it. None of them were ready to use the only way they had of stopping Lahmer.
"So how many will go with him?"
"I don't know. Maybe 20 or 30 of the construction crew. Maybe not so many. We worked like slaves to save this plant. I don't think any of my operating people will leave."
"So you can still run the plant?"
"I'm sure of that much," said Price. Johnny turned to the mayor.
"How about your people, especially your cops?"
"I doubt any will go," Bentley Allen said. "We had too damn much trouble getting here."
"That's good," Baker said.
He saw the look on the mayor's face.
"That they won't run. And, of course, you're staying, Barry."
The effect on Price was disturbing. He didn't look nonchalant or proud. He looked like a man in agony.
"I have to stay," he said. "That ticket's already been paid for."
"No, you wouldn't know.
When that goddamn hammer hit, I could go look for somebody in Los Angeles, or stay here and try to save the plant."
"I stayed."
His jaw clenched.
"So what do we do now?"
"I can't give you orders," Johnny said.
Price shrugged.
"By me you can." He looked to Mayor Allen and got a nod.
"Far as I'm concerned, Senator Jellison is in charge of this state. Maybe he's president. Makes more sense than the others."
"You too?" Johnny asked. "How many presidents have you heard about?"
5. Colorado Springs, Moose Jaw, Montana, Casper, Wyoming. Anyway, I'll take the senator. Give us all the orders you want.
Johnny Baker spoke carefully.
You didn't understand me. I've got orders not to give you orders. Suggestions only.
Price looked uncomfortable and confused. Mayor Allen and an assistant whispered together. Then Allen said,
"Doesn't want the obligation."
"Precisely," Baker said. "Look, I'm on your side. We've got to keep this plant going. But I don't control the stronghold."
Mayor Allen said,
"You may be the highest ranking..."
"Try to give the senator orders, me."
"Bullshit." "Just a thought, General." "All right, feudal obligations work both ways," Mayor Allen said. "At least they do if the king is Senator Jellison. So he wants to limit his obligations to us. So what suggestions do you have for us, General Baker?"
"I've given you some. Ways to build exotic weapons."
Price nodded.
"We're working on them. Actually, it only took thinking of them. You know, we've worked on defenses here. Not enough, I guess. But none of us ever thought of poison gas. Incendiaries we knew about, but we didn't make enough. Or enough muzzle-loader cannon, either. I've got a crew on that right now. What else?"
"Lay in supplies. No water shortage, and you've got the power to boil it. There's dried fish coming, and you can catch more. Get set for a siege. Our information is that the New Brotherhood is serious about taking over all of California, and very serious about wrecking this plant."
"If Alim Nassour is involved, they're serious," Mayor Allen said. "Brilliant man, and determined as hell. But I don't see his motive. He was never involved in any of the anti-industrial movements. Quite the opposite. We're just getting into the game, and now you say you're shutting it down. That approach."
"You're forgetting Armitage," Baker said. "Nassour and Sergeant Hooker together probably couldn't hold this army together. Armitage can. It's Armitage who wants the plant destroyed."
The mayor pondered.
"The Los Angeles area used to be famous for funny religions."
Tim was still hoping they wouldn't have to bring Hugo in. He spoke for Hugo.
"If Islam was a funny religion, go ahead and laugh, Mayor. They're expanding that way. Join or get eaten. They assimilate everybody, one way or the other."
"If the plant goes, they'll never have another one,"
Barry Price said. "They must be crazy." Was he talking about the New Brotherhood or the Stronghold? Nobody asked. But Baker stood up suddenly.
"All right. We are here with our guns and Dr. Forrester's notes. Tim, you go try on that wetsuit. Maybe we can dig up some of what we need to fight with. I wish I knew how much time we've got."
The policeman went up the slanting ladder slowly, carefully, with a fat sandbag balanced on his shoulder. He was sandy-haired and square-jawed, and his uniform was wearing through. Mark followed him with another sandbag. They added the bags to the barricade atop the cooling tower. By now, Tim's radio was nearly walled in. The man turned to confront Mark. He was Mark's own size and angry.
"We did not desert our city," he said.
"That wasn't what I meant."
Mark resisted the urge to back up.
"I only said most of us..."
"We were on duty," the policeman said.
"I know at least a couple of us were watching TV if we could get to one. The mayor was. I wasn't. First I knew, one of the girls was yelling that the comet had hit us. I stayed at my post. Then the mayor came through collecting us. He herded us all into elevators and down to the parking garage and packed the women and some of the men into half a dozen station wagons that were already loaded with stuff. He put us cops on motorcycles for an escort, and we headed for Griffith Park.
Did you have any..."
"I had no idea what was happening," Patrolman Wingate said. "We got up into the hills, and the mayor told us the comet had done some damage and we could ride it out here and go clean up the mess afterward.
Oh, boy. Did you see the tidal wave?"
"Oh, boy. Chescu, there just wasn't anything left to clean up. It was all foam and mist down there, and some of the buildings were still sticking up. And Johnny Kim and the mayor were yelling at each other,
and I was almost next to them, but what with the thunder and lightning and the tidal wave, I couldn't hear a word. Then they got us together and headed north.
The policeman stopped. Mark Chescu respected his silence. They watched four boats leaving with Robin Lawmer and part of his construction crew. There had been a shouting match when Lawmer tried to claim some of the supplies, but the men with guns, including Mark and the mayor's police, had won their point.
"We went through the San Joaquin in 4 hours," the policeman said, "and let me tell you, that was tricky driving. We had the sirens, but we spent as much time off the road as on. We had to leave one of the wagons. We got here, and it was already over the hubcaps, and that dike was a solid wall. We packed stuff from the wagons on our backs over the levees in the rain. When we'd done that, Price put us to work on the levees. He worked us like donkeys. Next morning, it was an ocean out there, and it was 6 hours more before I got a shower."
"Shower?"
The policeman turned to look at Mark.
"What?"
"You said it so casually. Shower. A hot shower. Do you know how long—"
"Skip it. All I ever said was, most of us had to do some running."
The policeman's nose almost touched Mark's. It was narrow, prominently bridged, a classic Roman nose.
"We did not run. We were in the right place to put the city back together again afterward. God damn it, there wasn't anything left. There's nothing left but this power plant, which the mayor says is officially part of Los Angeles. We're here now. Nobody's going to hurt it."
"All right."
The four boats were dwindling with distance. A few of the remaining construction men had climbed the levee to watch them go. Wistfully, perhaps.
"I expect they'll be fishermen now," Mark said.
"Try to imagine how little I care," the policeman said. "Let's get to work."
Horry Jackson cut the motor and let the boat drift to a stop.
"Far as I can tell, Wasco is just under us," he said. "If it's not, there ain't much I can do about it."
Tim looked at the cold water and shuddered. The wetsuit fit him, but there were loose spots, and it was going to be damned cold out there. He tested the air system. It worked. The tanks were fully charged, and that had been impressive, too. When the mechanics at SJNP hadn't had valves and fittings in stock, they simply went into the machine shop and made them. It was a reminder of another world, a world when you didn't have to make do with what was around, when you had some control.
"I keep thinking," Tim said, "if people's pet goldfish got loose, what happened to the piranhas?"
"Too cold for them," Jason Gilcuddy said, and he laughed.
"Yeah, well, here goes."
Tim climbed to the gunwale, sat balanced for a moment, and rolled off backward into the water. The cold was a shock, but it wasn't as bad as he expected. He waved at the boat crew, then tried an experimental dive. The water was as black as ink. He could barely see his wrist compass and depth gauge. The gauge was another of the SJNP crew's miracles, fabricated and calibrated in a couple of hours. Tim turned on the sealed lantern. The beam gave him no more than 10 feet of milky visibility. The sea in Emerald Bay off Catalina had been clear as glass. He had flown through seaweed jungles rich with darting fish. Long ago. He kicked down into the white murk, searching for the bottom, and found it at 60 feet. There was no sound but the bubbles from his regulator, the sound of his breathing. A shape loomed up in front of him, monstrous, hump-backed. A Volkswagen, he saw when he got closer. He didn't look inside. He followed the road. He passed an imperial with hordes of fish swarming in and out of the broken windows. No buildings. More cars. And finally, a gas station. But it had burned before it was flooded. He kept going. He would be out of air soon. Finally, civilization. Rectangular shadings in the murk. Visibility was too poor to let him be selective. The doors he tried were locked. Locked against the sea. He swam on until he found a smashed plate-glass window. It was frighteningly dark in there, but he forced himself to enter. He was in a large room. At least it felt large. A dense cloud of white fog to one side proved to be a rack of paperback books turned to mush and floating particles. The mist followed him as he swam away. He found counters and shelves, racks and goods toppled to the floor. He coasted above the floor, finding treasure everywhere. Lamps, cameras, radios, tape recorders, tensor lamps, television sets, nose drops, spray cans of paint, plastic models, tropical fish tanks, batteries, soap, scouring pads, light bulbs, canned salted peanuts. So many things, and mostly ruined. His air supply cut off abruptly. In panic, he looked behind for his diving partner, then realized that despite all his training, he was diving without a buddy. That was almost funny. You had to have more than one scuba outfit in the world before you could use the buddy system. He calmed himself and reached back to the air tanks, arm contorting to grasp the regulator valve and turn it to reserve. Now he had only a few moments, and he used them to scoop up objects and stuff them into the goodie bag tied to his weight belt. He left the store and surfaced. He was a long way from the boat. He waved until he had their attention and let them come to him. He was exhausted when they hauled him aboard. "Did you find any food?" Horry Jackson wanted to know. "We found some food with that scuba stuff before we ran out of air. We get back to Porterville, I can show you lots of places where there's food. You dive for it and we'll split." Tim shook his head. He felt an infinite sadness. "That was a general store," he said. "Can you find it again?" "I think so. It's right under us." Probably he could, and there would be much to salvage, but in his exhaustion he could not feel any excitement over his find. He felt only a terrible sense of loss. He turned to Jason Gilcuddy as probably the only man who could understand, if anyone could. "Anyone could walk in there and buy," Tim said. "Razor blades, Kleenex, calculators, books. Anyone could afford to buy those. And if we all work very hard for a long time, maybe a few of us will have them again." "What did you bring up?" Horry Jackson demanded. "General store," Adolf Weigley said. "Did you get any of that stuff on Forrester's list? Solvent? Ammonia? Any of that?" "No," Tim held up the bag. When they opened it, they found a bottle of liquid soap and a calyroscope. They all looked at him strangely, all but Jason Gilcuddy, who put his hand on Tim's shoulders. "You're not in shape to dive again today," he said. "Give me half an hour, I'll go down again," Tim said. Horry Jackson dug further into Tim's goodie bag. Fish hooks and fishing line. A vacuum tin of pipe tobacco. The peanuts. Horry opened the tin, passed it around. Tim took a handful. They tasted like a cocktail party in progress. "Diving can do funny things to your head," he said, and knew at once that that wasn't the explanation. All the world that he had lost was down there under the water, turning to garbage. Gilcuddy said, "Here, one sip left." He handed Tim a bottle of Hublin whiskey sour that Tim didn't even remember stowing. One sip, a blast of nostalgia on the palate, and he threw the bottle far over the water. And there, sinister specks on the eastern horizon, were the boats of the new Brotherhood. "Start the motor. Horry, start the motor, quick. They'll cut us off," he said. He strained forward for details, catching his balance when the motor started up, but all he could see was a lot of little boats and one much larger. A barge with things on it. "They've got a gun platform, I think." Expendables. It was not their fault that no one had told them that the real function of an army is to fight, and that a soldier's destiny, which few escape, is to suffer and, if need be, to die. T.R. Fehrenbach, This Kind of War. Dan Forrester looked exhausted. He sat in the wheelchair Mayor Seitz had brought up from the Valley Convalescent Home, and he was plainly fighting off sleep. He was padded against the cold, a blanket, a windbreaker with hood, flannel shirt and two sweaters, one of which was three sizes too big. That one he wore backward. A .22 bullet would not have reached his skin. The dairy barn was unheated.
Outside, the wind howled at 25 miles an hour, with gusts at twice that. It blew thin flurries of snow and sleet. The swaying gasoline lantern threw out a bright ring of light, leaving shadows of lunar blackness in the contours of the concrete barn. Three men and two women took turns rotating the cement mixer by hand, while others shoveled powders into it. Two of red, one of aluminum powder, while the dry cement mixer turned. When the powders were well mixed, others took them out and put them in cans and jars, then cast plaster of Paris around them. Maureen Jellison came in and shook the snow from her hair. She watched from the door for a moment, then went to Forrester's wheelchair. He didn't see her, and she shook his shoulder.
"Dan, Dr. Forrester?"
He looked up with glazed eyes.
"Yes." "Do you need anything? Coffee? Tea?"
He thought that through slowly.
"No, I don't drink coffee or tea. Something with sugar in it. A Coke, or just sugar water, hot sugar water."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, please."
"What I need," he thought, "is fresh insulin. There's nobody here who knows how to prepare that. If they ever gave me the time, I can do it myself, but first..."
"First thing is to bring the benefits of civilization back to the stronghold."
"What?"
"I might have known I'd walk into a war," he told Maureen. "I was looking for the haves. The have-nots were bound to be somewhere around."
"I'll bring tea," Maureen said. She went to the men turning the cement mixer.
"Harvey, Dad wants you up at the house."
"Right," Harvey Randall said. "Brad, you stay with Dr. Forrester and make sure..."
"I know," Brad Wagoner said. "I think he should get some sleep."
"I can't."
Forrester was far enough away that they didn't think he could hear them, and he looked like death warmed over anyway. The dead don't hear.
"I have to get to the other barn now."
He started to get up.
"Damn it, stay in that chair," Wagoner shouted. "I'll wheel you over."
Harvey followed Maureen out of the barn. He zipped up all his clothes against the wind, and they walked on in silence for a moment. Presently, he caught up to her.
"I don't suppose there's anything to talk about," he said. She shook her head. "You're really in love with him?"
She turned, and her expression was strange.
"I don't know. I think Dad wants me to be. Wouldn't that turn you off? Breeding for politics? It's Johnny's rank Dad wants. I think he believes in Colorado Springs."
Oddly phrased. "Well, it certainly would be convenient."
"It would, wouldn't it? Harv, Johnny and I were sleeping together before you ever met me, and not because I was ordered to, either."
"Yeah?" He smiled suddenly, and she saw and wondered, but he wasn't going to mention George Christopher's tirade. "No."
"Have I got a chance?"
"Don't ask me now. Wait till Johnny gets back. Wait till it's all over."
"Over? When is that?"
He pushed the thought away. Despair would be too easy. First Hammerfall and Loretta dead. The drive-through nightmare with Harv Randall curled around his wounded ego, a dead weight in the passenger seat. The fight to be ready for winter, for Fimbulwinter. The glaciers had been here once. Every damn boulder in that damn wall was a reminder. Harv tasted the urge to howl at the heavens. Isn't that enough? Wasn't it enough without cannibals, war gases, thermite?
"You didn't say no," he said. "I'll hang on to that."
She didn't answer, and that was encouraging, too.
"I know how you must feel," he said.
"Do you?"
She was bitter.
"I'm the prize in the contest. I always thought it was a joke, poor little rich girl. Suddenly nothing is funny anymore."
They reached the house and went in. Senator Jellison and Al Hardy had maps spread out on the living room floor. Eileen Hamner held more papers, Hardy's eternal lists.
"You look frozen," Jellison said. "There's something hot in the thermos. I won't call it tea."
"Thanks," Harvey poured a cup.
It smelled like root beer, and tasted much like that, but it was hot, and it warmed him.
"Progress?" Hardy asked.
"Some. The thermite bombs are coming along, but the fuses have to be made.
Over in Hal's barn, they're cooking up a god-awful brew that Forrester says will be mustard gas, but he's not sure how long it takes to finish the reaction. He's cooking it slow so as not to take chances.
"We may need it quicker than we think," Jellison said.
Harvey looked up quickly.
"Sir?"
"Deke's people sent us a message on the CB an hour ago," Jellison said. "Couldn't make it out. Alice took another CB out to get on top of Turtle Mountain."
"Alice? Turtle Mountain?" Harvey was incredulous.
"It's in line of sight to us and Deke," Al Hardy said, "and communications are better lately. It should work."
"But Alice? A 12-year-old girl?"
Hardy looked at him strangely. "Do you know anyone else who'd have a better chance of getting a horse up that mountain at night in the snow?"
Harvey started to say that of course he did, but then he thought better of it. If a horse and rider could climb that mountain in the dark, Alice and her stallion could. But it didn't seem right to send young girls out into the snow and dark. Wasn't that what civilization was all about, to protect Alice Cox?
"Meanwhile," Hardy continued, "we called in some reserves, just in case. They're loading up your travel-all."
"But what do you think Deke was saying?" Harvey asked.
"Hard to say."
Jellison sounded tired. He looked as exhausted as Forrester and had the same gray color. His voice was grim.
"You know the new Brotherhood tried an attack on the power plant this afternoon?"
"No." Harvey felt relief. The power plant was over 50 miles away. The new Brotherhood was there, not here. They'd be fighting Baker. Relief, then guilt, and he shrugged off the guilt because it was the last thing he needed now.
"What's happening?"
"They were in boats," Al Hardy said. "They sent in a surrender demand, and when Mayor Allen told them to go to hell..."
"What? Wait! Mayor Allen?"
Hardy showed his irritation at the interruption.
"Mayor Bentley Allen is in charge of the San Joaquin nuclear plant, and no, I don't know the details. The point is, Randall, that the new Brotherhood only had about 200 people for the attack on the power plant. It was not much of an attack, and it did not succeed, and they did not renew it."
Harvey looked over at Maureen. She was gathering up the thermos and some honey and brown sugar in a briefcase. She'd known about the fight at the power plant, and she didn't look as if she'd lost anyone there. He asked, "Casualties?"
"Light. One killed and the mayor's police. 3 wounded. Don't know how bad. None of them were from our relief force," Hardy said.
Good news from all over."
"I knew Bentley Allen," Harvey said. "I know he was on duty in central L.A. at Hammerfall. He's some kind of man to get out of that. Funny, though, how we always assume anyone who isn't at the stronghold must be dead."
Al, Maureen, the senator. They watched him thoughtfully, seriously.
"Not so funny as all that," he said. "All right, so 200 new Brotherhood attacked the power plant. That means..."
"What does it mean?" Harvey followed the thought to a conclusion he didn't like. "They thought the power plant would be easy. They sent their main strength somewhere else. Here."
"Sure. Here. Before we can get ready."
Hardy nodded, his lips pulled tight in a thin line, not a grin, a gesture of self-disgust.
"Damn it, we did the best we could."
"I was in charge," Jellison said.
"Yes, sir, but I should have thought of it. But we were so busy trying to organize for the winter, we never had time to think about defense."
"Hell, we've got defenses," Harvey said. "You couldn't expect a whole damned army to show up in the San Joaquin Valley."
"Why couldn't I?" Hardy demanded. "I should have. The point is I didn't, and now we all have to pay for my mistakes."
"Look," Harvey said, "if you hadn't gotten us all working on food, there'd be nothing here to fight for. You don't have to..."
The CB set beside Eileen came alive.
Alice Cox's voice came through clearly. High-pitched, young, and afraid, but every word intelligible.
"Senator, this is Alice."
"Go ahead, Alice," Eileen said into the mic.
"Mr. Wilson reports they are under heavy attack," Alice Cox said. "There are a lot of them. Hundreds. Mr. Wilson says over 500. Mr. Wilson says he can't hold them. He's sending his people out now, and he wants instructions.
Holy shit, Harvey Randall said. Tell her we'll have orders for them in 5 minutes, Senator Jellison said. Eileen nodded.
Alice, can they wait 5 minutes? I think so. I'll tell Mr. Wilson.
You don't sound surprised, Harvey said. You knew already. Al Hardy turned away. Senator Jellison spoke carefully.
Surprised? No. I had hoped the new Brotherhood would wait until their deadline ran out, but I am not surprised that they did not.
So what do we do now? Harvey asked. Al Hardy bent down to the maps.
We've been doing it since we got their ultimatum. I bet everybody we could spare from Forrester's work digging in up on these ridges.
He pointed to penciled lines on the map.
Chief Hartman and his people have been working up there 2 days straight. George Christopher isn't due back for 3 days. We hope he'll have reinforcements, but we can't count on it. Hartman's people are exhausted, and they are nowhere near through digging in. I gather that Forrester's super weapons are not complete.
No, he expected another week, Harvey said. Which we don't have, Jellison muttered.
Al Hardy nodded. Harvey, you've been working all day, but not outside digging the way Hartman's people have been. And someone must go buy us some time.
Harvey had been expecting that.
You mean me?
He saw that Maureen had paused, briefcase full of sassafras and honey in her hand. She closed the door without going out and stood at the door looking back into the room.
It's time I earned my keep, Harvey said. That's about the size of it, Jellison said.
He glanced at Maureen.
Was that stuff important?
She nodded.
You'll get to talk to him before he goes. He's got an hour or so, Jellison said.
Thank you.
She opened the door.
Be careful, Harvey. Please.
Then she was gone.
I've got some troops for you, Al Hardy said crisply.
Now that the decision was made, he was all business again.
Harvey thought he'd liked him better when he was sounding worried. Not the best people we have. Kids, I'm afraid.
Expendables, Harvey Randall said. He kept his voice flat.
If need be, Al Hardy said.
The worst of it, Harvey thought, is that it makes sense. You don't put your best people out to buy time. You keep your best troops to dig in, and you send out what you can spare.
Hardy can spare me. So can the Stronghold. We don't expect miracles, Senator Jellison said, but it's important.
Sure, Harvey said.
We want you to take the travelall, Hardy said. We put your CB back into it. Take the travelall and a truckload of gear and go buy us some time. Days if you can, but hours anyway. As the Senator said, we don't expect miracles. Deke's people will make a fighting withdrawal. They'll blow bridges and burn what they can on the way out. You go meet them. Take chainsaws and dynamite and the winch on that travelall and make a mess out of the road.
Put them on foot, Jellison said. Get the new Brotherhood on foot. Ruin those roads. That buys us a day, maybe more, right there.
And how long do I stay out? Harvey asked. He was having trouble with his breathing and hiding it.
You need time to psych yourself up, he thought.
That or zero time to get scared.
Jellison laughed. I can't order you to go sit there until they kill you.
Maybe I would if I thought you'd do it. Never mind. Just let Deke's people get past you, then come home, and take as long getting here as you can. Unless you've got a better idea.
Harvey shook his head. He'd already tried to think of a better idea.
You'll do it,
Hardy barked the question, as if trying to catch Harvey in a lie. It was irritating as hell, and Harvey barked back.
Yeah. Good man, Hardy said. Eileen, have the message relayed to Deke. Operation Scorched Earth is on.
Task Force Randall. A dozen boys, the oldest 17. Two teenage girls, Harvey Randall and Marie Vance.
What the hell are you doing here? Harvey demanded.
She shrugged.
They don't need a cook just now.
She was dressed for hiking, boots, hat with earmuffs, and several layers of clothing topped by a jacket that was all pockets.
She carried a scope-sighted rifle. "I've done some varmint hunting. I can drive. You know that."
Harvey looked at the rest of his command and tried not to show dismay. He knew only a few of them. Tommy Tallifson, 17, would be his other leader. He couldn't imagine what Marie's status would be. "Tommy, you drive the pickup."
"Okay, Mr. Randall. Barbara Ann will come with me, if that's all right."
He indicated a girl who didn't look more than 15. "It's all right," Harvey said. "Okay, everybody get in." He went back up onto the porch. "Jesus, Al, they're just kids."
Hardy looked at him, mildly disappointed, mildly disgusted.
"You're messing up my patterns," or, "don't make waves."
"They're what we've got. Look, they're farm kids. They know how to shoot, and most of them have worked with dynamite before. They know these hills pretty well, too."
"Don't put them down." Harvey shook his head.
"And," said Hardy, "they'll die just as dead if the new Brotherhood breaks through. Marie, too. You, too. Me, too. Hell, you're not going out to fight."
"Not with just 4 guns, we're not."
"These are the guns we can spare. These are the people we can spare. Just get out there and work. You're wasting time."
Harvey nodded and turned away. Maybe farm kids were different. It would be nice to believe, because he had seen too many city boys, older than these, in Vietnam. Kids just out of training camp who didn't know how to fight, and they were scared all the time. Harvey had done a series on them, but it had never been cleared by the army. He told himself, "We aren't going out to fight. Maybe it will be all right. Maybe."
They stopped in town and loaded supplies into the truck and onto the carrier on top of the travelall. Dynamite, chainsaws, gasoline, picks and shovels, 50 gallons of used crankcase oil, a bitch to move. When it was all loaded, Harvey let Marie drive. He sat in the second seat to let one of the local boys sit up front with the map. They drove down the highway, out of the valley. Harvey tried to get the boys talking, to get to know them, but they didn't volunteer much. They'd answer questions politely, but they sat wrapped in their own thoughts. After a time, Harvey leaned back in his seat and tried to rest. But that reminded him gruesomely of the last time Marie had driven the travelall, and he jerked upright. They were leaving the valley. It made Harvey feel naked, vulnerable. He and Mark and Joanna and Marie had gone through too much getting there. He wondered what the boys thought, and the girl, Mary Lou, he couldn't remember her last name. Her father was the town pharmacist, but she'd never been interested in the store. She seemed interested in the boy she sat with. Harvey remembered his name was Bill, and Bill and Mary Lou had both managed some kind of state scholarship to UC Santa Cruz. The others thought them odd that they'd want to go so far away to college. Marie drove up the ridge that led out of the valley. Harvey had never been up here before. Up on top of the ridge were moving lights, Chief Hartman's people digging in, still working at midnight despite the cold, blowing wind. The roadblock below the ridge had only one guard huddled in the small shelter. They passed it and were out of the valley. He saw it and felt it. They had entered the universal chaos left by Hammerfall. It was scary out here. Harvey held himself very still so that he wouldn't shout at Marie to turn the travelall and break for safety. He wondered if the others felt the same way. Better not to ask. Let us all feel that nobody else is scared, and that way nobody will run. They drove on in unnatural silence. The road was washed out in places, but vehicles had made paths around the broken pavement. Harvey noted places where the road could easily be blocked. He pointed them out to the others in the car. He couldn't see much through the intermittent sleet and the thick dark out there. The map showed they were in another valley, with a series of ridges to the south much lower than those surrounding the stronghold. This would be the battleground. Below lay a branch of the Tool River, the main line of defense for the stronghold. Beyond was territory Hardy wouldn't even attempt to hold. In a few days, perhaps only hours, the valley they were now driving through would be a killing ground, a place of battle. Harvey tried to imagine it. Noise, incessant noise,
the stutter of machine guns, a crackle of rifle fire, dynamite bombs, mortars, and through it all the screams of the wounded and dying. There wouldn't be any helicopters and field hospitals here. In Vietnam, the wounded were often in hospitals faster than they'd have been if they'd been civilians at home in an auto accident. Here they'd have to take their chances. They. Not they. Me, Harvey thought. Who was it that said, a rational army would run away? Somebody. But run to where? The Sierra. Run to Gordy and Andy. Go find your son. A man's duty is to his children. Stop it. Act like a man, he told himself. Does acting like a man mean to sit calmly while they drive you where you'll be killed? Yes. Sometimes. This time. Think about something else. Maureen. Have I got a chance? That wasn't a satisfying line of thought either. He wondered why he was so concerned about Maureen. He hardly knew her. They'd spent an afternoon together here a lifetime ago, and then they'd made love, and three times since, furtively. Not much to build a life around. Was he interested in her because she was a promise of safety, power, influence? He didn't think so. He was certain there was more, but objectively he couldn't find reasons. Fidelity. Fidelity to the woman he'd had an adulterous relationship with. In a way, a kind of fidelity to Loretta. That wasn't getting him anywhere. There were a few lights visible through the gloom, farmhouses in the battleground, places not abandoned yet. They weren't Harvey's concern. Their occupants were supposed to know already. They drove on in silence until they came to the South Fork of the Toole River. They crossed it, and now there was no turning back. They were beyond the stronghold's defenses, beyond any help. Harvey felt the tension in the car, and felt strangely comforted by it. Everyone was afraid, but they weren't saying it. They turned south and went over a ridge to the valley beyond. The ground seemed even and smooth on both sides of the road. Harvey stopped and planted homemade mines, jars of nails and broken glass over dynamite and percussion caps, shotgun shells pointed upward and buried just above a board pierced by a nail. Marie watched, puzzled. "How will you get them to walk out here?" she asked. "That's what the oil is for." They wrestled the drum of crankcase oil to the side of the road. "We shoot holes in that when we get past. When the oil's on the road, nobody can walk on it, drive on it, anything." The route beyond was ridge, valley, ridge, valley, with the road curving to cross low spots in the ridges. It was rippling landscape, a land with waves in it. 10 miles beyond the stronghold, they passed the first of Deke Wilson's trucks. It was filled with women and children and wounded men, household possessions and supplies. There were baskets tied to the top and sides of the truck bed, filled with goods, pots and pans, useless furniture, precious food and fertilizer, priceless ammunition. The truck bed was covered by a tarpaulin, and more people were huddled under it along with more goods, bedding and blankets, a birdcage, but no bird. Pathetic possessions, but everything these people had. A few miles on, there were more trucks, then 2 cars. The driver of the last didn't know whether any others would get out. They crossed a broad stream, and Harvey stopped and planted dynamite, leaving the fuses marked with rocks so that any of his party could find them to blow the bridge. There was a faint tinge of gray-red in the east when they reached the top of the last ridge before the low rolling hills where Deke Wilson's farm band lived. They approached it carefully, concerned that the new brotherhood might have got past Deke's people and come to secure the road. But no one challenged them. They stopped the travel all to listen. The infrequent popping of gunshots came from far away. "All right," Harvey said. "Let's get to work." They cut trees and built a maze on the road, a system of fallen trees that a truck could get through, but only slowly, by stopping to back up and turn carefully. They made dynamite bombs and put them at convenient places to throw down onto the road. Then Harvey sent half his troops out to the sides, the others down the hill. They cut trees part way through so that they would fall easily. The others ranged out to both sides, and Harvey could hear the growl of the chainsaws and sometimes the sharp whoomp of half a stick of dynamite.
The gray became a red smear behind the High Sierra when the work parties returned.
"A couple more trees cut, and one charge set off, and that road's blocked for hours," Bill reported. "This won't be so hard."
"I think we should do it now," someone said.
Bill looked around, then back at Randall.
"Shouldn't we wait for Mr. Wilson's truck?"
"Yes, wait," Marie said. "It would be awful if we stopped our own people from getting through."
"Sure," Harvey said. "The maze will stop the Brotherhood if they get here first. Let's take a break."
"The shooting is getting closer,"
one of the boys said. Harvey nodded.
"I think so. Hard to tell."
"It's officially dawn," Marie said. "Muslim definition. When you can tell a white thread from a black one. It's in the Quran."
She listened for a moment.
"There's something coming. I hear a truck."
Harvey took out a whistle and sounded it. He shouted to the boys nearest him to spread out and get off the road. They waited while the truck noises got louder and louder. It came around the bend, and there was a screech of brakes as it stopped just short of the first tree. It was a large truck, still only an indistinct object in the gray light.
"Who's there?"
Harvey shouted.
"Who are you?"
"Get out of the truck.
Show yourself."
Someone leaped out of the truck bed and stood on the road.
"We're Deke Wilson's people,"
he shouted.
"Who's there?"
"We're from the stronghold." Harvey started toward the truck. One of the boys was much closer. He stepped up to the cab and looked in. Then he backed up, fast.
"It's not..."
He never finished. There were pistol shots, and the boy was down. Something smashed Harvey in the left shoulder, a hard blow that knocked him backward. There was more shooting. People were jumping out of the truck. Marie Vance fired first. Then there was more shooting from the sides of the road and the rocks above it. Harvey struggled to find his rifle. He'd dropped it, and he scrabbled around for it.
"Stay down!"
someone yelled. A sputtering object landed just in front of the truck and rolled underneath. Nothing happened for an eternity, and there were more gunshots. Then the dynamite exploded. The truck lifted slightly, and there was a gasoline smell. Then it blew up in a column of fire. Fire danced in the air near Harvey's face as the gasoline was flung around. He could see human shapes in the fire. Men and women screamed and moved in dancing flame. There were more shots.
"Stop! Stop shooting! You're wasting ammunition!"
Marie Vance ran down toward the burning truck.
"Stop it!"
The gunfire died, and there were no sounds but the burning fire. Harvey found his rifle at last. His left shoulder was throbbing, and he was afraid to look, but he forced himself, expecting to see a bloody hole. There was nothing at all. He felt it, and it was sore, and when he opened his coat, he found a large bruise. "Ricochet," he thought. "I must have been hit by a ricochet. The heavy coat stopped it." He got up and went down to the road. The girl, Mary Lou, was trying to get closer to the fire, and two boys held her back. She wasn't saying anything, just struggling with them, staring at the burning truck and the bodies near it.
"He was dead when he hit the ground,"
one of the boys shouted.
"Dead! Damn it, you can't do anything!"
They seemed dazed now as they stared at the bodies and the fire.
"Who?"
Harvey asked. He pointed at the dead boy near the truck cab. The boy lay on his face. His back was on fire.
"Bill Dummery,"
Tommy Tallison said.
"Shouldn't we... What do we do, Mr. Randall?"
"Do you know where Bill planted the charges downhill?"
"Yes."
"Show me. Let's go light them."
They moved down the hill. Visibility was increasing fast. 100 yards, 200. They found a rock that overhung the road. Tommy pointed. As Harvey bent down to light the fuse, Tommy grabbed his shoulder.
"Another truck coming," he said.
"Oh, shit."
Harvey reached for the fuse again. Tommy said nothing. Finally, Harvey stood.
"It'll be light before they get up here. You go on back up the hill and alert the troops. They can't get past that burning truck anyway. Don't get close to it until you know who it is."
"All right."
Harvey waited, cursing himself. Deke Wilson, the new Brotherhood. Bill Dummery, with a scholarship to Santa Cruz and a girl named Mary Lou. My fault. The truck came on up the hill. It was loaded with people. No household goods at all.
In a car-top carrier on top of the cab, two children in bulky raincoats hunkered down against the wind. As the truck got closer, Harvey recognized the man standing in the bed next to the cab. He was one of the farmers who had come with Wilson to the stronghold. Something Vinge. The people in the truck were all women and children and men patched with bloody bandages. Some lay in the truck bed, not moving as the overloaded vehicle ground its gears and crawled uphill. Harvey let it pass, then lit the fuse. He followed behind it. He could walk almost as fast as it could go. The dynamite went off behind him, but the boulder didn't roll onto the road. The truck stopped at the log maze. There was no question about who was in this truck. The boys came out of cover. Vinge jumped down. He looked exhausted, but showed no obvious wounds or bandages.
"You weren't supposed to block the goddamn road until we got through," he shouted.
"Fuck yourself," Harvey screamed in rage. He fought for self-control. The truck was filled with wounded and with women and children, and all of them looked half-dead from exhaustion. Harvey shook his head in pity and resentment, then called to Marie Vance.
"Get the travel all. We'll have to use the winch to clear a way for them."
It took half an hour to saw through two logs and snake them out of the way so the truck could get through. While they worked, Harvey sent Tommy Tallifson down to try again with the boulder. At the rate they were using the stuff, they'd run out of dynamite right here, with miles of road still to block. This time, the boulder rolled. It formed a formidable obstacle, with no easy way around it. Others with chainsaws dropped more trees on the road.
"All clear,"
one of the boys called.
"You can roll."
Vinge went up to the truck cab. There were four people crammed into it. The driver was a teenage boy, 14 or so, barely big enough to reach the controls.
"Take care of your mother,"
the farmer shouted.
"Yes, sir,"
the boy answered.
"Get moving,"
the farmer said.
"And,"
he shook his head,
"get moving."
"Goodbye, Dad."
The truck crawled away. The farmer came back to Harvey Randall.
"Name's Jacob Vinge," he said. "Let's get to work. There won't be any more coming out of our area."
The fighting sounded much closer. Harvey could see across the hills and out to the San Joaquin Sea. There were columns of smoke to mark the burning farmhouses and a continuous popcorn crackle of small arms fire. It was strange to know that men and women were fighting and dying not a mile away, and yet see nothing. Then one of the boys called,
"There's somebody running!"
They spilled over the top of the hill half a mile off. They ran haltingly, not in any order, and few carried weapons or anything else. Running in terror, Harvey thought, not a fighting withdrawal.
"Run away!"
They flowed down into the valley and on toward the hill held by Task Force Randall. A pickup truck came over the top of the next ridge. It stopped, and men jumped out. Harvey was startled to see more men on foot to each side. They'd come over so carefully that he hadn't noticed them. They gestured to the people in the pickup, and someone in the back of the truck stood up and leaned on the cab. He held binoculars to his eyes. They swept over the men fleeing uphill toward Harvey, paused only a moment there, then swept up along the road, examining each of Harvey's roadblocks with care. The enemy had a face now, and the enemy knew Harvey Randall's face. So be it. In less than 5 minutes, the valley and ridge beyond swarmed with armed men. They walked carefully. They were spread out half a mile to each side. They advanced toward Harvey. The fugitives staggered uphill to Harvey's men and trucks and passed them. They breathed like terminal pneumonia cases. They held no weapons, and their eyes were blind with terror.
"Stop!"
Harvey shouted.
"Stand and fight! Help us!"
They staggered on without seeming to hear. One of Harvey's boys stood up, looked back at the grimly advancing skirmish line below, then ran to join the fugitives. Harvey screamed at him, but the boy kept running.
"Lucky the others stayed," Jacob Vinge said. Hell, I'd like to run, too."
"So would I." This wasn't going according to plan. The new Brotherhood wasn't coming up the ridge to clear the road. Instead, they were fanning out to each side, and Harvey didn't have nearly enough troops to hold the ridgeline. He'd hoped to delay them longer, but there was no chance.
if they didn't get out fast.